Welcome, this is Shane Kim, and back to everyone else. We've been practicing and talking about meditation, Zazen. Does anyone remember these three qualities of Zazen? I didn't mention earlier, but I would say more specifically the three qualities of calm abiding practice, or shamatha. Remember these three? Yeah. I think I mentioned last night.
I have them confused with the different three.
What three do you remember? I know, we have lots of lists.
Relax, have an object, and visualize.
That's it.
Pretty much.
Yeah. and you know,
we could an
object of meditation, yeah. And we could say that having an object of meditation and like attending to that object, or and we could call that mindfulness. That's my understanding of mindfulness. Sati in Pali, or Smriti in Sanskrit, means mindfulness, and also translated as recollection or remembering, actually. And in when they translate that into Chinese, they use the same character that's used for memory, interestingly, instead of like attention or something, memory, remembering. So I think that's one aspect of mindfulness, attending to the object, remembering that you're actually following the breath, remembering the breath, because what happens is we forget the breath. And we forget, that's we've lost mindfulness, we've lost smriti. And we could say that the vigilance aspect is related to this term in Pali, sampajana, or Sanskrit, samprajanya. And they often, in many sutras of the Buddha, he talks about sati sampajana, or smriti sampajana. They go together as a kind of a pair. And the sampajana means like clarity of consciousness, or clear comprehension, are ways it's translated. And one classic text also calls it awareness. I think this is referring to something similar to this alert vigilance. And this one text that defines it as its function is to clearly expose mental lethargy and dullness, and we might say, and distraction. So it's this vigilance clearly exposes when we're falling into either dullness or distraction. It's like the monitor. It's the monitor. Yes.
Yesterday I had a pretty quiet mind, and today I have a really busy mind. And so this vigilance keeps going into the struggle energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which isn't helpful.
Yeah.
So I wanted to bring that up and get suggestions about basically, I felt like I had to just really relax and say, welcome, you know, mm-hmm. welcome my thoughts, just say, you two are welcome, just like,
yeah,
to get out of this kind of vigilance.
Yeah, well, that's where the third aspect comes in, of relaxation, which kind of like, you could say, classically, this mindfulness and clear comprehension work together as a pair, but I also think that the clear comprehension or vigilance and relaxation work as a pair. All three work together as a team, as I mentioned. And I think there may be, like you say, I know exactly what you mean. And sometimes it's like we're trying to make this effort and, there's all these conditions. Like, why is it that today, I know, it's just like you, that's what's so interesting about Sesshin, right? You just never know day to day what it's going to show up. But just, I think that kind of real release, where it feels like the whole thing is, even we're trying to relax, but the whole thing feels too constricted and effortful and like a big chore, that kind of feeling. I think just like you said, that's one way to do it, is just almost like forget all about this whole meditation project. Just like, okay, and welcome, as you said, welcome is a nice one. Okay, just welcome whatever happens. Sometimes I'll like, take a really deep breath, let the posture settle maybe even a little more, like just almost like really relax, and almost like sometimes it's even like what we might call spacing out, like letting the mind really just, let it just do its thing for a little while, let it just run, and in a somewhat relaxed way. This is different than like obsessively working out some plan, right? It's not going that far, because that I think just feeds it. But to let it run for a little while, I think could be appropriate response. And then we can come, and then sometimes it runs for a while, and that's like, then it changes the energy and we can come back again.
Yeah. I want to ask, were you working on a thing with breath, or was there any object?
Yeah, all day yesterday I had two things which were really nice to balance, and one was this light attention to the breath which moves, and the other was attention to silence which kind of is flawed. And those two things together yesterday.
All my troubles seem so far away.
Yeah, and I was just like, how my energy was different. I was kind of trying to wrestle it into this other thing. And the whole welcoming, it's definitely different than pursuing the thoughts or, like getting caught up. But just,
it's an openness. Yeah, because openness is a quality of all this also. Silence, as you mentioned, like the kind of like a narrower and a larger object, which is similar to, as I was speaking of yesterday, like the maybe narrower object of the breath, which can be somewhat at the same time, or it's an aspect of the larger, right? The larger includes the breath. And I was saying larger as the sense of presence, the like immediacy of the moment with all the senses open. I think quite similar to silence, that might be your creative take on what that is. And because I think, I would imagine what you're talking about, it's the silence of the present.
It includes noise. I mean, it's not silence without noise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the immediacy of silence, this silence, not an abstract silence somewhere else. Yes, Chuck.
I thought it was interesting when you said kind of settle your body more, because I find with every session, the first day I might be pretty comfortable. And then as time goes on, the knees start hurting, the back starts hurting. By the end of session, I hurt everywhere. And, you know, I can certainly get times when I'm really comfortable and feel really settled, but at that point where pain just seems to be escalating, that's when I find it really difficult to just relax.
So, and we have, you know, so many admonitions about the posture being upright, and we try, and that's part of our style. And but I think there's, you know, it doesn't mean that we start sitting like this, but just the difference between this and this, you know, maybe, you know, we can experiment again in this laboratory. And I actually had this idea too, that before Sasheen, and maybe I'll just mention it. Like I said, we made a little bit of this rest period in the afternoon. We didn't have yesterday because we had an alternate schedule. But these, you know, two periods and then two more periods. And the idea, I don't know what you think about this, is to have, in the spirit of this experimental laboratory and really finding our way as a group, like, especially in a small session like this, is making it even more like flexible. Like if you feel like, I'm just doing this and I'm struggling through it, but I really want to, stand up, for example. Could we say, have the practice that, like, if during Zazen you really feel like it would be really helpful to stand up, just like go for it. Or maybe even do Kinhin while other people are sitting in the Zendo. Or if we're really drowsy or dull, that's another one. Well, I can't move till the bell ends, but maybe okay. We already say, of course, you can shift posture, but I'd like to propose that, like, even if you want to, like, get up, like, to find your, respond to your situation. What do you think?
Yeah. The only thing I would say is that the people that are going to be here tomorrow and the next day won't have heard that, so it can be confusing.
Well, I might say it again.
Yeah, if you say it again, so people...
Maybe we could even say in the afternoon, where it's a long time and we've gotten the morning, we're maybe still a little bit fresh. Maybe.
I just wanted to share this morning after breakfast, the first period of Zazen, I was extremely sleepy. And then my legs were hurting and here. So I just leaned back, used the back of the chair, and I didn't go to sleep, but I let myself go. I closed my eyes, but I was still aware of my being very sleepy, and it really helped. And in the next period of Zazen, I was able to sit up, and
it refreshed you. I think there's room for this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think in a Japanese Zendo, maybe there's not. They'll hit you with a stick if your posture slumps a little bit. But I think, I think that's Japanese Zen. I think, other Buddhist traditions, I think there's a lot more room for this. And especially because if you're meditating alone, then there's much more room for all of it. You really find your way, time your own periods. And so the advantage here is that it does create a lot of discipline of, mind training. It creates a really strong container that we couldn't really create on our own. And yet within that, see what we can do to find our way. It's different for everyone.
How far would you go? I mean, if somebody was really quiet during a period, could they walk outside very quietly and then come back in, or should we limit it to staying in the room?
Yeah, maybe we could say, because it might be actually if one quietly went outside, it might be less distracting to the others than somebody doing kinhin behind their back.
Right.
Keizan Zenji said that in one of the lectures that you gave, another session.
Mm.
He said, there's no point in sitting in Zazen if you're going to fall asleep.
Ah, get up and walk around.
Get up and walk around.
Mm. So, yeah. I think there's some places like Eheiji, I think they have like a kinhin hall that's like not in the zendo.
Uh-huh.
So you actually do go out and it's like a walking path out right outside. So
you know what's cool about it is in a way it becomes another practice of the grace with which you can do something like that without bothering everybody.
Yeah.
How gentle and quiet.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely want to take care of everyone else with sound, especially. But yeah, you know, like just for this session, and maybe starting with just the afternoons to say we can experiment like that. And you know, everyone's a mature practitioner here, so it's like I think the danger is if somebody's maybe just starting, then it's like, oh well, I'll just take advantage of it. And I think part of the advantage of sesshin is that it pushes us beyond what we think is possible. And this would be a way a little bit to like a little release valve in that aspect of it. But I think there's value to both ways. But yeah. So it's something to think about. And any other like questions? Or this is great to hear people's meditation experience. Anything else from yesterday? People happening? Yeah.
Just from last time, you were talking about the vigilance in the first description. You said that the vigilance is vigilant of the vigilance. And I thought that was very
interesting. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's like it's the monitor of the other two. And itself, and you know everything that's going on. Like it's this kind of watchfulness, and then there's this with doing that, there's a tendency for, and it's a little bit what Nanette was talking about, is that aspect can tend to get it's like working too hard or something. Vigilance can have that, so. Mixing with these other elements, because it's all one mind, can the vigilant monitor be actually relaxed at the same time? It's hard to talk about these different aspects and how they work together, but maybe a way where it's really clear and bright, and but it's becoming more and more effortless to be that way. Attention. Although I was kind of like these different words to go with these three qualities, I was calling the mindfulness, smirti, attention, because it's just attending to the object. So maybe this would be like a bright attention, brightening the attention, like sharpening the attention. What? Akarui. And some other thoughts about related to this is and related to this thing of like we have this specific practice of cultivating these three qualities instead of just be here. There's like when you're doing a specific practice like that, it has the danger of getting into like self-judgment that like, well, I'm not doing very well at it because now you have a criterion. That's the danger. If we're just sitting, like whatever happens, it's harder to be self-judgmental because whatever happens. But if we're working on these three things, I notice that can come up as like, oh, like that one, you know, it's not working. And why isn't it working? And both the self-judgment and the self-striving of like we're having, now there's an intention, we're like cultivating and deepening these three qualities, is like it can get into like the gaining idea thing very easily. So rather than just abandoning the whole thing because of that, I'd say what I was trying, when those things come up somewhat for me, one thing I found helpful was remembering the teaching of no self. Without getting, you know, it, we maybe all heard, and we could spend a whole session talking about what that means. But from as we understand it, that there's just this body and mind experience happening. There's nobody really, no independent self that's really controlling all of this. But when we take on practices like that, it kind of like it can activate that illusory sense that there's somebody here doing this. And that one is not doing so well, and that one is trying to become another one, a better one. and so to almost like release that idea of that it's like me that's not doing so well and trying to get somewhere, and almost let it come forth from the perspective of like Buddha nature, like our somehow this body and mind is engaged in this practice with these intentions, but could it be that actually all of this is coming from, it's in the world of human ideas and thinking and intentions, but it's actually coming forth from our Buddha natures, encouraging us to deepen our experience in this way. And so it looks like sometimes we're not doing so well at that, and we're trying to actually develop further in a progressive sort of way. But that all that's just like the expression of Buddha nature manifesting itself, as opposed to like me struggling to do this thing. Without a lots of long kind of stories and explanations to ourselves about what that means, just releasing the sense of the smaller self, and still this great effortful activity and development can continue. It's a different way of thinking about it.
For me, beginner's mind is coming up as we speak. It has a sweetness to it, and you know, being willing to just go back there, you know, or to understand that we're always there, you know. But a little, if it's okay, a kind of little anecdote about that I find is just happening, is happening in my life that's being so helpful, is I just partnered doing music with a guy that's on my level. On my level, I think, is beginner.
As a musician?
Yeah. But that's the thing. We're able, wherever we're at, and whatever somebody else would call us, one doesn't feel like, oh, I have to, this, I'm now playing with a superior musician. We somehow meet in a place where if we have to go over the changes of all the things you are for an hour, just to get comfortable before we can do anything else, that's fine, because we're just saying, look, that's where we are. I'm not going to try and prove to you, you know, that I can really, you know. And there's such a comfort in this type of relationship where we feel like we're just both learning.
Yeah.
And we can just take as long as we need on one thing, you know, one guy. I don't know.
That's a great point. Great example. Yeah. A beginner's mind. And that's how, I think that's in my own case, I feel like, wow, this is like, I feel like kind of a beginner at this, actually.
Well, you were saying yesterday, I mean, which really, I think, was awesome. I'm sorry, I can't help the enthusiasm about how you felt like maybe you wasted all this time. Well, I mean, time will tell. I doubt it. But, who doesn't have that thought, and for you to sit here and, admit and share along with the rest of us, I found today using the idea, which I had sort of fallen away from, I put it away as something, I did that years ago, watching the breath.
Mm-hmm.
But not only watching it, but thinking of with this project, I have a project, which is my idea is Hara. I've talked about it, and that is a way of being and of living from the gut.
Mm.
So for breath, then I use what you were talking about, and I know, and Ellen knows the idea of, collecting energy with the inhalation, and then we're not sucking, what's the word, Ellen, for when you bring the energy down to the dantian, sinking. So gathering. This is what I'm doing. This is not a truth, right? This is the imaginary thing I do. I gather air on the in-breath, and then on the exhale, I sink it to my dantian, and I'm constantly trying to put my energy and my attention there. So that's just a project, and so if I'm comfortable, not in the discomfort, like Chuck was saying, where everything is no fun and you can't do anything. But if I somehow got me uncomfortable, I have this project, and it's like, I'm irritated when the bell rings. Because I'm working on this thing. I'm doing nothing. But you reminded me to sort of go back to that. And today, I've been doing it. It's been a totally different day, except for the temporary. I'm not putting my body's
Yeah.
This project now.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I sometimes have that when the bell rings too. I was just getting into it. Which is a little bit I think that's when the gaining idea thing is coming in there too. So it's more that's when we just let it go. The bell rings.
Yeah, I'm happy that I wanted to sit in there.
Yeah. How wonderful. And it's similar to talking about the breath and the dantian. I think my version yesterday was a little bit like the reverse, on the inhale, it's sinking down.
It is.
But both ways, same effect.
I think it's perfectly legitimate, however.
Either way, yeah. Same effect, I would say.
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. So this is the laboratory. Any other zazen points? So, also, I thought of one last point about this self-judgment and seeking thing when you have a project, which tends to bring those things up. I think that, no self part, that it's not like the little me doing all this, that the project can continue, but the project is sponsored by Buddha nature instead of me.
Absolutely.
And then it can continue even more wholeheartedly.
Right. Oh, you're done. You got to get that.
But also, the kindness and compassion part. These basic practices or I'm really looking at this year and trying to encourage us to really look at, directed towards ourselves particularly. If it starts to get too may this body and mind be happy and free from suffering, and may all beings be like that too. And that just opens up the whole constricted kind of tightness also. So that's another skillful means it can apply. I was thinking about what Richard brought up yesterday about his doubts about, can we do this outside a monastery? And in some ways, I feel like we create a little monastery in Sisheen. But I thought, well, what are those qualities? What is it? And I thought of this list, so I brought, this is coming from, you know, this is his book, Meditation on Emptiness, but this is coming from the Indian tradition, where, you know, very sort of methodical structure. There's a wonderful section on cultivating shamatha, or calm abiding, but this is the prerequisites for achieving calm abiding. Just like before we even sit down to meditate, let's gather these prerequisites. There's six. The first is staying in an agreeable place. And this agreeable place has five qualities. And I think this is the point. This is how you would want to design. You'd want to find a place to practice with these five features of an agreeable place. So we think of mountain monasteries, but it looks like these five features, I think, we have here. We could debate about it, but the I mean, this is coming from old India, right? But the first feature of the agreeable place for cultivating calm abiding is good acquisitions. One needs easily obtainable sustenance, like food, not involving wrong livelihood or offerings from sinful persons. So, I just saw Jane, I passed her on the path bringing a soup today. So we had an offering from a non-sinful person arrived today. And it's easily, we have these easily, living in Santa Cruz, maybe we have this requisite fulfilled more than if we went out into the Ventana wilderness or something, just like into a cave, and we're foraging for berries and herbs. That would not be easy to sustain or find our sustenance. But it works out pretty well here. Like, the food, we have a wonderful tenzo, and living in town, as opposed to like in the wilderness, outside, you know, in the wild wilderness, it actually makes it, we don't have to worry about that so much. It's maybe more helpful. Of course, a mountain monastery, I don't know, maybe if they're growing their own food, maybe they have no time for shamatha, actually. Oh, really? Oh. That would be hard. That would be hard if you... Yeah, we need food and water. And easily obtainable. So I think we basically have that covered here. The second feature of an agreeable place is a salutary location. Salutary. Maybe it means like auspicious. And this is staying in an area blessed by the presence of former holy persons affords blessings. But if such is not available, one should at least not stay where those who have lost their vows dwell, where the spiritual community has undergone disturbance, or where there are fierce animals, robbers, non-human evil spirits, and so forth. The old way of talking.
The one thing I want is fierce animals.
So we have had somebody almost got in a fight with a raccoon next door last year. A really like vicious raccoon had to jump up on top of their car. So occasionally things like this happen. Yeah, so you know, that's true. Some things that don't happen in the mountains happen here, you know, we lock the doors at night. But, you know, it's all relative. Maybe Coben was a holy person that blessed this place. I think many, many great practitioners over a long time, I think if you have if a practice place has been somewhere a long time, I think it does accumulate some kind of like blessings or intangible, inconceivable energy, practice energy. I feel that in other practice places too. And many great beings, I think of, like, many people consider Lama Tarchin Rinpoche one of the great masters of his tradition that radiates blessings. And just, he came to speak here last year. He used to teach here regularly. So there has been, you know, some disturbance in the spiritual community, maybe here, maybe every community. And at times here, I felt like the conditions were like, I felt some like dark energy of disturbance at different times of just how things were. And I feel like, I don't feel that now. These days, I feel like there's a lot of harmony and the practice, you know, that's due to all of us just practicing, right? So all that creates an environment that you can, we co-create, that like creates a good place for practicing calm abiding. If we knew like a bunch of the Sangha was like totally like fighting or had some really nasty feelings or something, it would be harder to practice here, actually. So third quality of an agreeable place is, it's a salutary place. This is, the place should not generate hot or cold diseases, and the area and water should be agreeable. And Kathmandu, where I was practicing a little bit this January, it's like the air is just thick with exhaust. It's definitely blessed by many, many holy people. But like, you know, people are coughing. It's like, and there's, you can't drink the water. And it's easy to get various diseases. I think this is just, practice in America in general is, has these benefits for calm abiding, actually, I think. Fourth is salutary friends. It's harmful for beginners. It's harmful for beginners to stay alone without friends. And thus, one should have at least three companions. One, two, three. Whose views and behavior are concordant and whose presence promotes conscientiousness. This is the whole idea of Sashin, practicing together. Also, since sound... sound is the thorn of concentration. One needs to be free from the sound of humans during the day and of dogs and water, etc. at night. I guess it means running water. Yeah, and you know, personally, if I was, you know, designing the nature of Tassajara, in the summer I think that stream's okay, but in the winter when it's this raging river and it totally dominates your auditory faculty day and night, I wouldn't design that into it.
I would. It
talks a lot.
It talks. Yeah, it's like, wow.
Yeah.
What have you got a lot to say?
I've heard that feng shui people, I think they say for quiet, for meditation, try to avoid like fast running rivers. And I've heard it's an energetic feng shui thing too. It's like the river carries too much of like, it like pulls you, it's too much movement, something like that. But anyway, we don't have that here. Water, but we don't have many dogs at night. Again, Kathmandu is just like dogs barking all night. And people during the day, we have a little bit with a school next door. But I was, when I was doing yesterday some, I noticed there was a conversation happening and I was really present with this. I was at that point doing this, the wider meditation, all the senses open. But the vigilant monitor was like really awake there, and it was a very interesting experience. And I would, you know, come out of it and sort of the laboratory technician who's taking notes in the white coat, you know. Very interesting. He'd sometimes come out of it and take some little internal notes. And one of it was like, how interesting. I could hear these two women talking, and it was like, I could hear the words, and like, sort of like about 4 to 5 words kind of pieced together with like a little bit of content, but the vigilant one was like, it didn't go beyond 4 or 5 words, so it wasn't whole, it had no sentence content. Usually I get involved in the content, but it was so like present, this word, that like, it wasn't so much that it was just the sound of a consonant and a vowel, it was words. But like, it was so interesting how it would dissolve before the sentence finished. I was like, I actually had no idea what they're talking about, but I'm totally alertly hearing the words. I don't know if I've ever had that experience quite like that. So in some ways, that's an advantage of people talking. Occasionally we can experiment with. Yeah. Yeah. You can use it as the object. Yes.
I'm having some kind of wanting to, I don't know, resistant to this perfect set of ideas.
Yeah.
And your story from yesterday came up about was it City Center or Tucson?
City Center. Shaking, noisy person. Yeah.
Just because
who helped me.
I think that we need to be careful about the setting up the perfect. You know, get the perfect cushion, and you have like, you know, no noise or interruption.
Perfect temperature.
That kind of bubble, cozy bubble.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't think necessarily. It's kind of like.
Yeah, it's a middle way issue.
If I need to depend on these,
yeah,
so
yeah,
in the right outfit, so that nothing,
yep,
in the right,
yep, yep, yeah, the right food,
yeah,
and just the right amount, and yeah, all these things is like. So I think, like you say, it's a middle way because it's definitely, that's the whole function of the outer retreat. Is we set it up to support our practice. We try to set up the outer conditions to support us, but if we get obsessive about trying to make it perfect, it will never be perfect, actually. I don't think there's such a thing as perfect. You know, even if it's a completely silent place in a beautiful natural setting, then we're going to get sick or something. So it's there's no end. So it's interesting to hear that you try to set things up. We do make an effort to, especially during a calm abiding meditation retreat. We need, you know, I think it's, the tradition says it's these prerequisites. Because I think if it's in the middle of a really like, on Market Street or something, to sit on the sidewalk and try to, you know, practice calm abiding. People sometimes try to do that, but I think it's a super advanced practice. So we can work up to that.
Yeah. I mean, I have to share a not so positive thought that I did have yesterday and I had last night, and it's a matter of coming to terms with it, which you could help me with. You know, and that is that at least at some point I have to recognize that this is crazily luxurious and safe and beautiful, you know, compared to what's happening in Syria. You know, and I don't want to dwell on that kind of thing, but I mean, my God, you know, the idea of how would, you know, or some beaten up refugee or something, how would they like to trade and come and sit here with the opportunity to meditate and talk about philosophy and Zen, you know, and it's like, oh, some part of me goes, ooh, you know, and then I have to say, well, you're doing it, you know.
Do it for them. In some way, you know, with your intention, because that is, it's for, they're part of all beings that we wish to be happy and free from suffering and live our life for. We might not meet that person face to face in this life, but with that intention. And it's like, because they don't have the chance, we will do it for them as one big human family. Even like, you know, and then sometimes, I think it's more common, like in Asia, there's the feeling of people's lives are too busy, they don't have a chance to practice, but they like to support other practitioners to go on retreat, because they're like, I can't do it, but I actually like that you're doing it, and I think you are doing it for me. So, you know, maybe the Syrians in some part of their heart could feel that. That they might instead of being jealous that we're doing this, they might rejoice that we're doing this. Could be. Mm-hmm.
That's good.
All together.
Otherwise, it's a little sticky and uncomfortable.
Yeah, and maybe a little bit related to that, and Nanette's point about the perfect place is, you could say, yeah, this actually. It could be too perfect. It could be too comfortable and everything where it's like the God realm, right? It's like, and maybe like a little bit of that struggle is actually beneficial to practice. So maybe for us it comes in the form of people talking on the street. And for some of the practitioners of the past, it came in terms of like just finding like a little bit of like of herbs to eat for the day. Is there, you know, maybe they saw as a positive struggle that you're really like day to day on the edge of living so simply that you're some people maybe valued that. It looks like they did because people chose to live that way, right? So that's another part of the balance between the perfect setup so we could just sit down and boom, we're enter shamatha and a little bit of difficulty, the middle way.
Anybody know what that bird that's just singing away out there is? Anybody know? Nobody knows.
It's good not to know.
It's fine. It's
just hear the sound.
These just going and everything.
Hear the sound without further identification, which is part of. Like this example with these women talking, in my understanding and the way I'm trying to practice with this kind of calm abiding object of meditation, including the vigilance, is we do identify that, oh, that's a bird singing. And if we happen to know birds well, we even identify what species of bird. Naturally, if it's just naturally in our mind, and that does not disturb calm abiding, that it's not about like never having a single conceptual thought. It's that it's just not going further than that, not elaborating, and also the kleshas, you know, the emotional afflictive emotions arising around objects. So it's like. The bird, and it's a robin, you know, okay, and then back to like, now my butt hurts, now the breath, and the kleshas will be like, and I really wish that bird would stop, it's been chirping all morning, or like, I hope it continues because it's such a perfect ambiance for zazen, that bird song, it reminds me of being in the mountains, or you know, then we're like, in a way, those could be the kleshas are coming in there and are activating our mind, either conceptual thought streams or emotional complications. That's what the vigilant one is noticing and releasing, and Sometimes I've even heard talked about this alert aspect. If we're really kind of cooking with it, I think this can be done in a completely non-aggressive way. It's interesting that this term vigilance could have that edge to it, so we have to be careful because it has to be totally gentle. But if a thought arises while we're just attending to the present, especially with this wider field of awareness where it's very easy to stray off into thought streams, that if a thought arises, that's okay, but then immediately release it. Not like obliterate it or something, but just, it will release itself if we don't feed it, but just immediately we're in the present. And that's what, if the vigilant one is really vigilant, it's like, there's the bird and like, da, 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 da. And sometimes that can be done in a way that's like so joyful. And when we're really in that space, it's like we know that it will diminish the full flow of this actually joyful, peaceful, vibrant, calm abiding if we follow it out. So it's kind of like, here it comes, just release it. It's not like a kind of, here comes this, get rid of it. It's like, that vigilant one is so happy to release it. But, and immediately, not like, well, let me just follow it a little bit more because I love this thought. And that's where it's really vigilant. It's like that immediacy. And that, I think it's hard to confess my own zazen. It's like, there were times yesterday, because I'm really consciously working on this, when I would get to that point, but a lot of the time, it was not like immediately releasing thoughts. It was more like working with a lot of what the thought is actually for me is thought comment about the meditation, right? It's like really like, here's the structure of these things, how are the three doing, this is a little commentary. And it's quite different than just thinking about some random other stuff, because it's kind of about what's happening now, but that's still kind of disturbing the shamatha. So I think that's a stage that we're like working with those thoughts.
Thinking about sound, sometimes a sound can wake you up.
If we're kind of spaced out, you mean,
right? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about, like, if you're in an environment where there's a lot of sound,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, it's raining or people are talking, and even if you're not attached to it, and you're just, you're not saying, I don't like this, mm-hmm. I don't like it, but you're just kind of being with it.
Yeah.
In a way, it's, I don't know, preventing is the right word, but if it was silent, mm-hmm. then you get to notice what your mind does habitually, mm-hmm. whereas if there are these mm-hmm. sounds going on, that's what your mind is, mm-hmm. as opposed to the...
So it sounds like you could almost say you're using the sound as the meditation object, actually. And when it's just silence, it's maybe harder to use silence as the object. Although Nanette was trying to do that. Although she said her silence included sound. I think it could. So these things, it could be that way. And depending on the person or the period of zazen, it could be the other way too. It could be like, when it's really, really silent, one maybe could really settle into just vibrancy of presence with no other thing. But I can understand how it could be that way too. That silence, our mind chatter is more prominent if it's really silent.
And then somebody sneezes and
yeah.
You know, it wakes you out.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be, if it is really silent, then we notice that we really wake up or something, then we have to maybe wake up the vigilant monitor, because it's probably, I think if we're really, really clearly awake like that, and then someone sneezes, then it's almost like no difference. But if we're like a little bit getting into that murky territory, like we're comfortable and sitting and we're not too distracted, but it's not bright and clear. It's relaxed and it's slightly, somewhat mindful, but the vigilance is like maybe not even there at all, which I think this is often how Zazen can be, right? And I think of my, 10 years or so of wasted Zazen, I think a lot of it was like that. I was actually, sleep a lot in Zazen, fall completely asleep, but this dull, partly it was maybe I wasn't getting enough sleep, although I'm maybe getting less sleep now, but some kind of subtle aversion or like boredom sets in, I think. So I noticed that's one thing in my experience with this kind of practice we've been talking about, this particular project, like developing calm abiding with these three factors, I get less bored doing that because there's something to do, actually. And I say, there is actually something to do here. And it's like, and it's a project. So because it's a project with something to do, I haven't gotten bored yet in this session. Whereas I think the fact that it's a project with something to do and not boring is good for setting this foundation. And that's why it's not the whole story. Because I think the full extent of the whole story of the practice and realization of totally culminated enlightenment is it's actually a non-doing. It's a non-project. Again, I think that's the danger of Zen. If you go right to that at the beginning, it's easy to slip into boredom or this like undertow of like not conscious grasping thought, but like subconscious, like when we're on the verge of sleep and there's a little bit random storyline that if we were to trace it out, it's not about anything. Or it's, sometimes you can watch the patterns, listen to the kids and oh, that reminds me of yesterday and that kid and then another memory. You can see how they all link together, but there's not much grasping because it's not like obsessed about any of it. This one into this one into this one. But that's just like called daydreaming.
but I mean, I don't want to let go of this idea of being touched by sweetness or beauty, so that if in spring birds are celebrating and singing, and if it brings me, even with my project, joy just by being in the presence of this lovely moment, that to me, I'll never trade. that's what I'm living for. That's what I'm practicing for. So if it comes, why should I practice through it?
And you get more of those moments when you're cultivating calm abiding.
Absolutely.
Like I just really notice more and more. Like you walk out of the zendo because you get so used to the zendo environment, and you walk out into the spring.
It's so alive.
Yeah. So and that's great. That's a blessing. That's a gift. And so, and even during Zazen, when there's a sweet feeling or something, fine. But if that's our whole Zazen, then we forgot the project, right? Okay. So it's like, we're working on the project and we don't get obsessive about it, like, I'm gonna not miss one moment, even a whole period. It's not even realistic, for one. And, so enjoy, those things. And not get carried away. Is what I would say.
Well, Ryokan did. If we know his story, he just get lost.
I think that's.
Where were you all day?
That's something else. That's a valuable. He's his being, right?
It's his being.
Yeah. So that's okay too. But I wouldn't say that's like cultivating calm abiding. And maybe he did that for a while, and that was the result. That was more his kind of ultimate result. And again, you know, no rules what you do with your mind here.
Well, I can say on my way walking from my car after Zazen yesterday, the stars looked different, the moon looked different. I was struck in a different way.
Yeah.
I'm thankful for that.
Yeah. There's so many things, right? And good to keep in mind, like, what is our overall intention? I think that for myself, I see that all these are all like fruits of the practice along the way, but they're not the whole fruit. And it's just like, oh, you know, we can maybe get into that too, of like, Sashin, we do get it into the space where we're touched by the moment more fully. And I think it's wonderful, and I love it, and celebrate that. And I think if that were the whole, if that was all it was about, then I would question making all this effort for that. And question, is that really what most benefits others? And it may, you know. I question it. I don't say definitively one way or the other. But the further I get into the practice, the more depth I see is possible. I see that those are like gifts along the way as we go deeper and deeper. The last factor of an agreeable place is, sort of doesn't seem to fit so much in with the place, but possession of the pleasant articles of yoga. Through hearing and contemplating the teachings, one should eliminate false ideas with respect to the object of meditation and become skilled in the essentials of practice. Maybe that. Through hearing and contemplating, so there's these three kinds of wisdom. Wisdom from hearing and contemplating and becoming. So here, through hearing teachings about meditation and contemplating, thinking about them, to see if they make sense for us, one should then eliminate or let go of false ideas with respect to the object of meditation and become skilled in the essentials of practice. So maybe you could say this is kind of classical teachings, maybe this is Sashin, so we're kind of doing that. It's like, here are some particular, let's like really be clear what the meditation object is, and eliminate false ideas about meditation objects, like no object or whatever, or just whatever happens, which are all these versions of practice we could try out. So being really clear, whatever it is, being really clear, hearing teachings and checking out, do I want to try this out or not? And then working on it. And then those are the five qualities of an agreeable place. But just while we're on the list of the other prerequisites for calm abiding, besides the place, the others are few desires. Not having great, you know, too much desire for particular food, clothing, and so forth, either of good quality or great quantity. So in the old days, maybe that's all some yogis were really working with is basic food and clothing. And we could get into wanting lots of other stuff too. But in Sashin, we get down to some basics. So we're just like, it's okay to be up for lunch when it comes, but like not... If we're thinking about it all day long, I wonder what the next meal will be, then we're like, it's a distraction. Second, related to few desires, is knowing satisfaction. One should be satisfied with gaining only mediocre food and clothing. For if one is not, and instead is attached to them or wants something other than what one's getting, one will be distracted to the purposes of accumulating and keeping things, and meditative stabilization will not be generated. That's part of the setup, part of the nice thing about it. The food just comes and we just receive it. Fourth, so we have staying in the agreeable place, few desires, knowing satisfaction. Fourth is pure ethics, keeping the precepts. Ill behavior of body and speech should be restrained and pacified through the precepts. For if one is dominated by coarse discursiveness, one's mind will not abide in a natural state. And fifth is forsaking commotion. If commotion is not abandoned, time will pass in senseless activities and conversation. One needs few purposes and few activities in Sashin. This coming of its own accord, if a meditator has few desires and knows satisfaction, the earlier ones. So all these different activities, one lets go of. Also, making effort at something of small purpose, such as a minor topic of scholarship, does not achieve the essential purpose, much like being attached to sugar cane, but not taking the sugar. So, reading and understanding and learning calm abiding without actually practicing it is a distraction, actually. It's commotion, even. And lastly, thoroughly abandoning thoughts of desire and so forth. They're all kind of similar. And then the next section is the object of calm abiding, which we've been talking about. So this is the foundation of calm abiding with the shamatha, is calm abiding with the object of the breath or now-ness, the present experience, or the wider experience, or whatever, any other object. And like Richard even asked about some, what about like a saying or something? And I think for calm abiding, it could be like a saying, it could be almost anything, but the function of it is to let go of discursive thinking. So the danger with any kind of saying is it's kind of a conceptual idea. So if it's like a, sometimes there's things like, if you're working with the koan mu, this means like nothing, then you could just, if you have just the saying, without the whole story of does a dog have Buddha nature or not, you just sit with mu or like nothing. I think that's what would generate calm abiding. It's like, but what about all sentient beings have Buddha nature? Nothing. What about cats and squirrels? No! No, just cuts through. I think Dogen even says something like, talks about mu, using mu at one point, and saying, when with mu, how can you hold on to anything? So that's the, whatever object is cultivating this non-discursive, non-conceptually elaborating mind. And then tomorrow we could get into just turning the light of awareness around backwards, which I would call vipassana, by the way. So that's this other side of the story. Why did he say it wasn't?
I don't know. I was wondering if you have thought about that.
Yeah, the sound of one hand is a little bit, has a little different thing, flavor than, because it's a whole, like, almost like, it's a question.
But also it's a state.
Yeah, so if you're actually meditating on the sound of one hand, okay. Yeah, that sounds like moo.
As opposed to moo.
Yeah. Yeah, it depends how you do it and all of this stuff. And I think it's different than what you're doing in Zazen with those type of koans, and then what you present in the Dokusan room is maybe different than your actual Zazen practice.
Yes.
Now you're going to like, because now we're like in the world of people meeting people and expression. Mm-hmm. So you bring the Zazen experience of Mu into the world of expression. So again, not, you know, having trained in this whole koan system like that, I just know that Dogen was very into teaching koans and using them as like teaching tools, but it seems that he never says to bring it into Zazen. It's kind of like when you're sitting Zazen, you're just sitting Zazen, and then between Zazen periods, you're going to hear a lot about koans, and Dogen's constantly talking and bringing up these stories, and then they maybe percolate into Zazen. Or my teacher said something like, you don't need to bring it into Zazen, but if you're thinking about koans and studying them all the time, or you're thinking about the three aspects of shamatha all the time and like, you know, talking about that and stuff, then that's probably going to come up in Zazen. Which I find, you know, it really works that way for me. Is like, I'm thinking about this, because I'm giving these talks, I'm thinking about it all the time, maybe too much, on breaks and stuff too, right? So it really, like, so during Zazen, I have thought about almost nothing but like the practical aspects of Zazen, the whole sesshin. And as I say, those are somewhat distracting. It's somewhat distracting, but it's less distracting, or it's, I feel like it's closer than just thinking about, you know, what I'm going to do next week. I didn't even remember there was a next week.
It's close to following the breath, pretty close.
I think thinking about the aspects is actually kind of distracting.
I mean, just holding a koan, or like,
oh,
what was your original purpose before you were born? You know, I mean, it's crazy, you know, it's absurd, but it's not, if you just think that all the time, you're not going to be doing a lot of...
Yeah, so some koans have more of that flavor than others, like that one. Like, yeah, what, you know, who is this before my parents were born, and like without saying the words over and over, the feeling of that, the gist of that is, you know, in a way that's kind of, I would say, a kind of a turning the light around koan. But then it's some that are much more complicated. So actually Keizan Zenji does say, at one point, I think he's talking in the Zazen Yojinki, where he's talking about some like practical techniques for Zazen. He's saying, I think he says, if your mind's really like scattered and discursively thinking a lot, take up one of these koan sayings. But he says, take a flavorless saying. So some koans have a lot of flavor and they're complex stories with dialogue going back and forth. And he says, take up one of the flavorless stories, like Mu, or he mentions the Mu koan, and maybe that one about your original face, and some others that, like, I think he mentions, like, you know, what's the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming from the West? The oak tree in the garden. I think he brings up that one, and a couple others that are like really, really simple, like just this kind of koans. And those ones might actually concentrate your scattered mind. to the lab. Put on your stethoscope. If there's any merit gathered in the vicinity, let's offer it to everyone, including those in Syria and people in struggle and famine and fighting throughout the world. May it touch their heart in a little, almost inconceivable way, brighten their day. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.